Okay, tonight I'd like to pick up in the book of Job. And if you can't find it, if you find a book of Psalms, the Psalms is about halfway through the Bible, and if you back up a book, you're going to find the book of Job. All right? And if you can't find it, there's don't worry about it. Don't fumble through for the rest of the Bible study trying to find it. But just in way of brief background as far as Job is concerned, Job is a very, very unique book. Of course, every book in the Bible is unique in its own way, but the book of Job, it is a fascinating book in many ways because it deals with human suffering, the puzzle of human suffering. I mean, the riddle, the enigma, the mystery of human suffering. I mean, this has been a question that people have asked almost from the beginning of time. Why, in terms of looking around, and especially look around our world today. Look at the incredible suffering that's going on in our world today. I mean, in Pakistan, thousands of people die in an earthquake. Well, we just had, we just got slapped upside the head with two hurricanes here. Natural disasters are happening all over the world. And people are suffering immeasurably all over the place. And, I just picked up the latest Time magazine, and it's talking about this bird influenza that they feel like it's going to be a pandemic. A pandemic is an epidemic that's spread geographically, almost worldwide. I mean, it's just far-reaching. Back in 1918, I think it was like... I've read figures anywhere from 20 million to 100 million, so I don't know who's right, who's wrong, but it could be just untold millions died of influenza back then, and then how many people have died in wars in the last century? I mean, the list could go on and on and on as far as, why? Why does this happen? Why does that happen? Well, that's what this book of Job is about. I mean, it's dealing with suffering, it's dealing with pain, it's just dealing with disillusionment and death and dying and sickness and even physical unattractiveness. I mean, this book is really, really unique. It's a book that is filled with poetry and prose, and it's been viewed by many people as being probably a masterpiece as far as its literary content. I think it was Martin Luther who looked at it as being that, having an unequal. I mean, this book is so unique that there's no less than even 110 words in the book of Job that you won't find any other place in the Bible. And the book of Job, I mean, its height, its breadth, its depth, and what it covers is just amazing. I mean, it not only talks about God and Satan, it talks about men and devils. It speaks of constellations and stars, and, it talks about various metals and precious stones, and it even talks about marine dinosaurs and land dinosaurs. It talks about insects and reptiles and birds and animals and weapons. It talks about military strategy. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I mean, it talks about musical instruments and geography and modes of travel and whirlwinds and talks about weather patterns and weather itself. It speaks of, deep human emotion. And it's just filled with, like similes or metaphors that deal with, like when Job talks about even life, he refers to life as breath or a shadow or a runner or, an eagle. Or, I mean, there's all kinds of different ways that he expresses himself there. And another unique thing about the book of Job is nobody really knows for sure who wrote it. I mean, there's been speculation. I've read people who thought that, anywhere from Hezekiah to Solomon might have written it. And there's a character in this book of Job named Elihu who speaks of himself in the first tense that may indicate that he wrote it. But I personally believe that all the evidence seems to suggest that it was written by Moses himself. And that this story took place some 4,000 years ago. We're not even sure exactly when it took place. But an interesting thing is that it says that after Job goes through all of his sufferings, it says he lives 140 years after that. So if you back up, if you go back to, let's say, the time of Abraham, I mean, Abraham lived to be 175 years old. Abraham's father, Terah, lived to be, I think it was 205 years old. Isaac lived to be 180. Jacob lived to be 147. And Joseph lived to be 110. I think Moses lived to be 120. I mean, the longevity was there 4,000 years ago. So I'm assuming, okay, and this is speculative on my part, that it was around, probably prior to the time of Abraham, all right, around that time of there. And this book, it speaks of a character that I think a lot of critics have said, well, Job was just a fictional character. Job never existed. Job, was just some figment of somebody's imagination. But if you go to the fifth chapter of James, James talks about Job. He says, remember the patience of Job. And if you go back into the 14th chapter of Ezekiel, God himself says to the through the prophet Ezekiel, when he's talking about how he's going to bring tremendous judgment upon his own people for their wickedness and their idolatry and their waywardness, God says to Ezekiel that if Daniel, Noah, and Job were there among the people of Ezekiel's day, they would be the only ones that God would spare, and he would only spare them because of their righteousness. So what I'm saying is this: Job is not a fictional character. Job is referred to in the New Testament as well as the Old Testament. It's referred to by God himself, all right, in other portions of Scripture other than the book of Job. Just keep these things in mind, all right, when we go through this book, because it deals with, well, like I said, tremendous suffering. And one thing, if you look in 1 Peter, before we even get started, I mean, you don't have to turn there, but 1 Peter in chapter 4, Peter says this: "Dear friends, do not be surprised by the painful trials you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you may participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed." And then it goes on to say, "So then those who suffer according to God's will should commit themselves to their faithful Creator and continue to do good." All right? And also, you know, Paul, he tells us in Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he says, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us." He says, now listen to this. This is what Paul says about a lot of times what we have to go through in life. He says, "We are hard-pressed on every side but not crushed, perplexed but not despairing, persecuted but not abandoned, struck down but not destroyed. We always carry around in our bodies the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body." And then he goes on to say further down, he says, "Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us the eternal glory that is far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporal, and what is unseen is eternal." Anyway, I could go on and on and on about suffering, but I just wanted to kind of set this stage or set this background when we're reading this book, because I think we probably have heard of, and a lot of people have heard of, the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. You know what I'm talking about? Where you have preachers that will stand up and say, "Hey, listen, it's a name it and claim it. All you have to do is just have enough faith, or just claim to God in faith for a healing, for wealth, for material things, for any number of things that you could list as far as this world is concerned. You just bring it before God in prayer, and you just believe that you're going to get it, and you're going to get it." Well, I'm telling you, that is a lie right out of the pit of hell, all right? Because this health, wealth, and prosperity gospel, it doesn't hold up under the Scripture, under scrutiny of Scripture and experience in life. And I'm telling you right now, most Christians in the world today are living in abject poverty, and they're living in, many of them are living under, you know, very difficult circumstances. And they're being persecuted, they're being tormented, they're being tortured, they're being imprisoned for their faith. I mean, over the past 100 years, more Christians have been martyred for their faith in Jesus Christ than all other recorded history and combined in terms of when the church began 2,000 years ago. So don't buy into this health, wealth, and prosperity bit, all right? You know, sure, if we have faith, okay, we can ask God for things. We can ask God for healings. We can ask God for material things. We can ask God for any number of things, all right? Jesus himself said, "Whatever you ask for in prayer, it will be given unto you," all right? But all these things are conditional. And I just want to say that, hey, there is another side to this coin that we always have to balance out the Scriptures with, because I'm a firm believer in this, that Scripture, if it is preached out of balance, it becomes heresy, all right? So we have to have an understanding of every Scripture in light of all other Scripture to get its fullest understanding, all right? And this book, I think more than any other book in some respects, kind of opens that door, you know, that ironclad door of the supernatural, to just give us a little peek, a little glimpse of what's going on behind the scenes in terms of this spiritual battle or this spiritual warfare as far as the spiritual realm is concerned. So beginning with verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men in the east. And his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one of on his day," in other words, on his birthday. "And they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it came about when the days days of feasting had completed their cycle, that Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him in all the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now, and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse thee to thy face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. Now it happened on that day, when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, that the messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the people, and they died. I alone have escaped to tell you." Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. You know, like I said, it's quite an interesting story, isn't it? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine anybody even being able to compose this kind of a story on their own. This story is an episode that took place, and God is putting in his word for our instruction, for our edification, for our reproof, for our example. This is why he's given it to us for a lesson. Because I look at the book of Job, and I have often, when I've gone through this book and I've thought about this man, I thought to myself, you know, this guy has went through the mental, emotional, physical agonies of the damned. And when he was going through this hell on earth, he had no answer as to why, what was the purpose, why, what was happening to him and everything like that. But looking back in retrospect, look at how this episode or this incident in this man's life has touched the lives of countless millions of people throughout the ages who have probably read this book and have found some kind of strength and inspiration to carry on just when they feel like giving up, just when they feel like despairing, just when they feel like God has abandoned them and there's no point in going on anymore. They read this book and they find encouragement to say, well, I don't understand just like Job, but I could follow his example. I mean, this guy is something else. You read this man, look what God says about this man, because this is God's opinion of Job. It's just not his own opinion. I am so fed up with people who say, well, I'm basically a good person. I'm fed up with that kind of mindset. I really am, because there is no basically good person. But here's an exceptional man here. Exceptional man. It doesn't mean that Job has never sinned in his life, but this is God's estimation of him, because look at that verse 1. It says, "There was a man in the land of Uz." Now, we don't know exactly where Uz was. I've read different commentaries that say, well, it was in Edom, and Edom is somewhat below Israel itself. I don't have a map up here, but I kind of suspect that it was more towards Babylon, and the reason I say that is it mentioned the Chaldeans here. The Chaldeans are the, you know, another name for the Babylonians. So I think it was further east. I don't think it was necessarily down in Edom, but that's neither here nor there. But it does say he was the richest man in all the east. All right. He said, now this is, he was a blameless, upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. Now, he says he's blameless and he's upright. Why do you think there's two distinctions there? A person who is blameless is a person who you may look at outwardly and you not see anything in them that you could blame them for, all right, in terms of wrongdoing. But what are they like inside, all right? simply because a person may seem to be an upright person, you don't really know what goes on behind closed doors, so to speak. You don't really know what's really going on in their heart, what's really going on in their private life. You see what I'm saying? So, in other words, a person can be blameless, all right? This is the way the scribes and the Pharisees were, right? They were blameless in many respects because Jesus himself said, you are like whitewashed tombs, you know, whitewashed sepulchres, that you are full of dead man bones. I mean, in other words, on the outward appearance, you seem to be really impeccable as far as your religious commitment is concerned. But inwardly, they were all defiled. What I think that God is suggesting here is not only is he blameless outwardly, all right, but inwardly as well, all right? In other words, this man was true to his character. Look at how many like televangelists that we have seen fallen over the years. You can look at Jimmy Baker or Jim Swaggart or, you know, any number of guys who became household names virtually. And they seemed to be blameless on the outside, but then their true character came forward and we saw what they were really like. Well, Job wasn't like that. He was blameless. He was upright. He says he was fearing God. You fear God, that's the beginning of wisdom. When you fear God, what that basically means is this. When you realize that you're going to have to stand before God someday and you're going to have to give an account for your life to him, then you're going to live your life accordingly. If you go into a store and you feel tempted to pilfer something with your five-finger discount and just walk out the door without paying for it, all right, if you fear God, you're going to say in the back of your mind, you know what, I may get away with this real easy, but I'm not going to get away with it in the eyes of God. So I'm not going to do this. See, that's fearing God, isn't it? And he says here, turning away from evil. In other words, you know, we are told in the New Testament to flee temptation. We turn away from it. All right, we don't put ourselves in that situation. Well, that's the way that Job was. Anyway, long story short, it goes through and here and he lists the number of possessions that he has. First of all, he has 10 kids, and apparently they're all grown. So I'm under the assumption of this. Even though it tells us that Job lived 140 years after all this took place. So I'm under this assumption that he was probably around 50 to 60 years old when this took place. And the reason I say that is because apparently his kids have grown up. He's raised 10 kids. And they seem to be mature enough where, you know, some of them may have been teenagers, but apparently most of them were young adults. And they would get together and they'd celebrate each other's birthday. So I'm just kind of assuming this here, but he had 10 kids. And then look, he had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camel, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys. It specifically tells us what he owned. And because at the very end of the book, all this is going to be doubled, what God's going to give him back. But you see, he's going to suffer a tremendous loss. That's why God tells us up front exactly how rich this man was. And then he says here that what he would do is when his children would get together and celebrate each other's birthdays, after their celebration, he would get together with them and he would offer sacrifice to God, an animal sacrifice to God, on behalf of each one of his children, making intercession for them just in case there's any wrongdoing in their life. All right, in case they inadvertently have cursed God somehow or offended God some way. Man, look at the type of character this guy was. I mean, I'm really impressed with him because he prayed for his children constantly. This is, to me, is a tremendous inspiration for, I think, fathers. You know, we really got to take our responsibility serious before God to uphold our children in prayer. I am adamant about that. I think parents should pray for their children continuously, every single day. Don't take anything for granted, because we all have fallen natures, and our children can get into, you know, the biggest messes of their life if they're not having people pray for them. I mean, I don't care how, you know, people can be behind bars and, well, he was such a good kid, he was such a wonderful child, and all that. Hey, you know what? You needed to pray for this kid a lot more, because none of us are immune to sinning. And Job knew that, and he upheld his kids before God in prayer, constantly praying for them. Now look what happens. I think this is very interesting. It opens up this door for us, this ironclad door, as far as the spiritual realm. And it says, now verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Now the sons of God are the angels of God. All right, and Satan also came among them. Now people read this and say, what? I thought Satan was thrown out of heaven into hell, because Jesus has told us in the Gospels that he saw Satan fall from heaven like lightning. In other words, he was flung from heaven like a bolt of lightning, him and all his rebellious hordes of angels, and God instantaneously created hell and threw him into it for their rebellion. But Satan does have access to heaven. Even though he's been cast into hell, he has the ability to roam the earth, and he also has access to heaven. We know this. We read in the book of Revelation, all right, I think it's the 12th chapter, it tells us that even though Satan has this access to God in heaven, you know, as a matter of fact, let me just read it so there'd be no misunderstanding of what I'm trying to drive at here as far as what I'm talking about. Chapter 12 of Revelation, it says, "And there was war in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven, and a great dragon was hurled down, and the ancient serpent called the devil, or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying," now listen to this, "Now have come the salvation and the power of the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ." Listen, "For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been thrown down." In other words, Satan does have access to heaven, and what does he do up there? You know, he spends so much time accusing all of us before God, saying, you know, "Look at that worthless maggot down there. Do you see what he did? He's just there constantly accusing the brethren." Well, he's going to finally be thrown out of heaven permanently, 3.5 years in the tribulation period, where he will no longer have access to God's throne room. All right, but he does have that access now. I think some Christians don't understand that, but he does. He does have access to God at this point in time. Anyway, God poses this question to him. He says, in verse 6, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among with them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' And Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it.'" Interesting thing. Remember what Peter tells us? In his epistle, he says that Satan roams around the earth like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. All right? Satan says here, "Well, I'm roaming around the earth and walking to and fro on it." Roaming kind of gives you the impression that he's always looking around like a lion seeking a prey. He's always looking for some way to destroy somebody. All right? But also he says he's walking around on the earth, meaning that, you know, when you walk, you're going in a definite direction and a definite pace for a definite purpose. So even though he's doing a lot of roaming around, seeing how much more destruction he could do, he definitely has purposes already determined of what he's going to do. Were you going to say something? No, good question. Satan is not all-knowing, all right? But understand something. He can speak any language backwards and forwards. He can quote the scriptures backwards and forwards. I mean, this guy is, we are no match for this guy. Understand something. His intelligence. We go back and read in Isaiah, we read in Ezekiel, that he was perfect in wisdom, perfect in beauty. There was no flaw in him. His intelligence almost knew no bounds. He was so, you know, magnificent that he thought he was as good as God. See what I'm saying? But he's still limited, all right? And we find out that he's limited when we read this. But don't underestimate his power. We don't want to overestimate it, because stronger is he who is in us, which is Jesus Christ, than him who is in the world. But don't underestimate this guy. There's no doubt in my mind. He knows our thoughts. Every person in the world, I mean, there's 6 billion people plus on this planet that I know, that he knows what everyone's thinking. Huh? That's how much power he has. I know I've read books where people say, "No, he doesn't know what anybody's thinking. He just has a whole network of demons to tell him what's going on." I don't believe that. He knows exactly what's going on. He has a lot of power, all right? But he's not omniscient. He's not all-powerful. He's not all-knowing. And then it says in verse 8, it says, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on earth, blameless and upright, fearing God and turning away from man.'" Now, this is the second time this is said about this man. "And then Satan said to the Lord, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands and his possessions and has increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now and touch all that he has, and surely he will curse you to thy face.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him.' So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord." So, in other words, the challenge has been thrown out there. This is what God said. All right, have you considered him? And then Satan's got an answer right off the bat. He says, "Well, what do you expect, man? The guy's serving you. I mean, you're giving him everything. You build a hedge around him. I can't get to the guy. I can't mess up his life. He's been given the tremendous wealth. He's been given everything that a man could want, he has. So why doesn't he serve you? I mean, what the heck, you know? He's got it made." And so he said, "But I'll tell you what, you take away everything that you've given him, he'll curse you to your face." Now God says, okay, you can take everything away. But then what does God say to him? He says, "You can take it away, but you can't touch him." See, he's on a leash. He can only do what God allows him to do. His power is limited. So here's the interesting thing. The challenge is thrown out there, but here's what I want to here. I'm going to say this right up front so I don't forget it, all right? You know, most people in the world could handle adversity better than they can handle prosperity. You know what I mean by that? In other words, when we are going through difficult times, it's a lot easier to cling to God and to seek God and to try to live for God and walk in God's presence, right? But if everything's been given to us, the chances are we're not going to be able to handle that. What do we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 1? It says, hey man, consider your calling. You know, there's not many mighty among you, not many noble, not many prestigious people among you. In other words, if you find a person of great wealth, chances are that person is not committed to God. Chances are that person does not have a deep relationship with God. Now, there are exceptions, but the general rule of thumb is that, hey, man, if you have a great deal of wealth and prosperity and influence and power and prestige, chances are you're really not walking with God. That's what even the Bible tells us, all right? But why? Because men can't really handle prosperity. It's going to cloud their vision. It's going to give them a false sense of security. It's going to, you know, make them feel autonomous or independent from God. But a person who's going through great trouble very often will cling to God or look to God or search for God or seek God. You see what I'm saying? But here's the thing. Job served God when he was the wealthiest, the richest, the most powerful, the most influential man on earth. And he served God with his whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. So you know what God knew right off the bat? God knew, hey, you know what? Job is passing his hardest test. His hardest test is not adversity. His hardest test is prosperity. So God knew, hey, look it, if he can pass this test, then he'll pass any test. So the test is thrown out there to the devil. Have you considered my servant Job? And so the devil says, hey, man, take away everything you've given him, and he'll curse you to your face. That's all there is to it, right? We wonder sometimes, hey, Lord, why can't I just win the lotto? I'd be faithful to you. I'd be true to you. Well, he knows half the time. You just, you know, forget him in a heartbeat. As long as, you know, everything's going your way. This is what I'm talking about as far as people and prosperity. Anyway, just to wind us down, in this chapter down, look at Satan's timing. He didn't go immediately out of the presence of God and then start beating up Job as far as all his possessions are concerned. He bided his time. He waited for the right time. What time did he wait for? He waited for when all his children were together. He waited for a very strategic time. He was going to hit Job with one punch after another. He was just going to, the one to him, you know, and just one blow after another. And that's exactly what he did. When his children were there, all right, got together for their birthday party, says, okay, now's the time to strike. And so what did he do? It says here that in verse 14, he says, Now it happened on that day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking in their oldest brother's house that the messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. Now here, look at this. Look at all the thefts and the murders that go on in the world today. I guarantee you, the devil is behind it. You can see it right behind here. All right, every murder, every abortion, every theft, everything from bank robberies to hijacking, but everything, every suicide bomber, the devil's behind it all. Believe me, he says. And so what happened? They were attacked by the Sabaeans, and then one servant came to tell Job, and it says while he was still speaking, it says fire fell from God from heaven and burned up the sheep. You know, I mean, how many sheep did it say he had? I think he said it's 7,000 sheep were burned up. So it wasn't just a strike of lightning. I mean, fire came down from heaven. So this looked like it was the hand of God that did it, right? But it's the devil that did it. All right? Keep something in mind. When we are reading the book of Revelations, we are told that the false Christ and the Antichrist, he's coming with all the powers and the signs and wonders of Satan. And it says that in the presence of the Antichrist, the false prophet calls down fire from heaven. And somehow he's going to really impress men with this. I believe that it may be when this fire is called down from heaven by the false prophet to deceive the world, it may be in conjunction with a complete deception of UFOs or something of this nature. But I'm just pointing this out that he has the power to do that. And he did that. And then right after his servant came and reported that, it says that while he was still speaking, another came and said the Chaldeans formed three bands of raids. And they, what did? They slew the servants at the edge of the sword, and they took all of his other livestock, his camels. And then while I was still speaking, he says another one came, and they said that a great wind came and then did what? Destroyed all his children. A great wind. We are told in Ephesians that Satan is the god of this age. All right? The god of power and air. All right? He does have power over the elements. All right? But his power is limited, and he can't do anything unless God allows him to do it. All right? Look at all the destruction that's happening in the world today. God's allowing a lot of it because people are just have turned from God and really have you know, thrown a lot in with the devil, and he's just raising havoc everywhere you turn. Well, what happens when all those things happen to Job? He turns around and he says this in verse 20. Job arose and tore his robe, and he shaved his head and fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there." I mean, instead of cursing God, he looked at the situation. He says, "You know what? Everything I own, my children, my home, everything belonged to God." All right, I've said this before. You mean, you see this house here? I mean, I really feel blessed to have this home. No question about it that me and my family are able to have this home. But this home to me is just a loan. This home is not mine. This home is God's, right? And if it goes up in smoke, you know, I pray to God I wouldn't shake my fist in his face and look what you did, because, this is his. If he wants to take it, he takes it. You see what I'm saying? We have to understand that everything we own comes from God. But how many people realize that? We need to see that very clearly, that everything we have in life is just a loan, and it's a blessing from God. We're to enjoy it. It's not something that should own us, okay? It's something that God has given us to have a subservient role, to be used for his glory and for his honor. All right? That's what we try to use this home for his glory and for his honor. But everything belongs to him. We have to have that mindset rather than thinking that, well, you know, this is mine, because believe me, you can't take it with you. When you die, you ain't going to take anything with you, believe me, other than the influence that you've left here, the impact you've made on the world around you. That's what you're going to end up taking with you. And so anyway, it says, "Naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God." Anybody have any questions on this first chapter? Okay, listen, let's pick up, because the story continues for chapter 2. It says, "And again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, 'Where have you come from?' And Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him in all the earth, that a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil, and he still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause.' And Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face.' So the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, he is in your power, only spare his life.' Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, 'Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die.' But he said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips.' Now when Job's three friends heard of all the adversity that had come on him, they came each from his own house, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamanite, and they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept, and each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads towards the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great." Oh, yeah, isn't this something, this way this story is unfolding? Okay, now, you know, the devil, you know, comes back and presents himself before God. And God asks him the same question. "Have you considered Job, man? Look at him. I mean, you've ruined him. I've allowed you to ruin him as far as materially. Okay, economically, he's destroyed. And yet he still, you know, clings to his integrity. He doesn't curse me." And the devil, I'm sure he thought this through. He just knew that when he presented himself before God, God was going to bring up this unpleasant reality, okay? And so when he did, Satan said, "Oh, man, skin for skin, get real. I mean, the guy will do anything to save his little hiney. I mean, the only reason he haven't cursed you because he still wants to hang on to his health and to his life, you know? That's the only reason he's not cursing you." He says, "Hey, man, you take away his health, he'll curse you to your face." And so what did God do? He says, "Okay, you can touch him, that you can't take his life. You see, he's just a wild animal, but he's on a leash, okay? The first time around, Satan could touch all his possessions, but he couldn't touch him. Now he could touch him, but he can't take his life. You see, he's limited. His power is limited. God gets this far, no further. All right? So Satan figures, okay, now I'm going to break this guy. And can you imagine the type of hatred, the type of contempt, the type of determination the devil had to destroy Job? Because what was at stake here was his own saving face before God. You know, he wanted so desperately to show to God, see, I could break a man. I don't care how good he is. A guy just doesn't serve you with pure motives. That's it, pure and simple. It was so important to the devil. It was just absolutely paramount to him that he win this challenge. That he proved God wrong. So you can. I just feel sorry for Job. I feel sorry for just the thought of how the devil was so determined that he was going to throw everything, including the kitchen sink, at Job to get him to curse God. All right? So look what he's doing here. Look at Job. First of all, it says here that he goes from the presence of God, and then he smotes Job with boils. Okay, now boils, I think, if you've ever had a big pimple, well, I think it's kind of like that, only it's bigger, it's harder, and it's very, very painful. He's covered in boils. All right? Covered in them. And then he says he's sitting among the ashes with a broken piece of pottery, scraping his boils. Scraping the pus out of his boils. This guy must have looked so, I think, pathetic. All right? I mean, one look at the guy would have really moved you either to disgust or tremendous pity. Just looking at him and say, oh my gosh, this poor guy, look at him. You know? And when he says he's sitting among the ashes, you know what that means? It's the dump. He's in a junkyard. He's in a dump. That's where the ashes. No, that's it would burn all the garbage and all the refuse. They take it to the dump and they burn it. So now, when he smote him physically, apparently he was even ostracized from his own home. All right, whether he's living in a tent or a house or something, wherever he's living, his wife apparently still stayed there with whatever servers may have been left. All right, to try to pick up the pieces. But they, you know, once he was smitten physically. I mean, they just ran him out of town. I just thought, this guy's a leper. This guy, get him out of here. So now, where does he go? He's homeless. He's homeless. He's living in a garbage dump among the ashes, sitting there, scraping his boils, all right, with a broken piece of glass, pottery. And his only means of probably even sustaining himself at this point was to feed upon whatever garbage was thrown out, you know, by the surrounding villages.
Where was his wife?
She was still, in other words, even though he lost all his possessions, he still had a tent to live in, and so his wife was still living there. Interesting thing too, the devil didn't take his wife, you know. No, right? No, I'm not gonna start
open
a can of worms.
No,
I'm not gonna.
Did she try to change his mind?
Right. Okay. Now here's the thing. All right. The question has definitely crossed my mind. Well, he took all his children. Why didn't he take his wife too? Well, the devil knew. Hey, I can get to the guy with his wife. All right, there's no doubt about it. That's why he spared his wife. He could have taken his wife. Go look at the power of a woman has over a man. I've written about this, I've talked about it, I've preached about it. The power of a woman is incredible over a man. It really is. You go back to the very first... Hey, I'm serious now, all right? Hey, wait a minute, all right? Hey.
You missed a beat there.
I know. They're at it over here. All right. Hey, you know, you guys know nothing. You know nothing. I'm saying it's this. All right. When Satan sized up Adam and Eve, what did he say? This is speculative on my part, okay? But he sized them up and he thought, you know what? I'm not going to get to this man. I'm not going to get to him. And I'm not saying that, you know, out of any male chauvinism here. I'm saying that because if you read in Timothy, Paul says that, hey, it wasn't the man that was deceived, but the woman being quite deceived fell into transgression. So the devil sized them both up and thought, you know what? I'm not going to be able to flim-flam this guy. I'm not going to be able to do it, regardless of how hard I try. This guy's not going to buy, you know, my BS. So he said, but he looked at the woman and said, but I know this, I could probably get to her. She's more gullible and I can get to her. And if I get to her, then I can get to him through her. Because he doesn't want to part with his little dumpling here, so he's going to do anything for her. So, you know, long story short, what does he do? He gets the woman to sin. And then it's just a domino effect after that, because the devil knows, once I get her, she's just going to influence him. Because he doesn't want to be without her. That's where your first sin comes in. And you look at Elijah. He was the greatest prophet. You know, he stands up against 450 prophets of Baal. He stands up against them. single-handedly. All right? And then the next day, the woman Jezebel threatens his life, and he's running scared of a woman. You know what I'm saying? Look at Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived. You know, look at him. You really question his wisdom. When you look at his life, he's the wisest man that ever lived, and he's tripped up by all of his wives. He had 700 wives, 300 concubines, in other words, 1,000 women. You know, and they really ruined him spiritually because of their influence. Well, what about Samson? He was the strongest man that ever lived. You read his feats. I mean, few men, in my opinion, in the Bible had more potential than Samson. Look at the mess that he made out of his life because of women. So this is what I'm trying to say, is that Satan sizes up the situation and says, you know what, I can make his life even more miserable by leaving his wife here and just goading him with her. And so that's what he did. He kept his wife, and then his wife, I feel sorry for his wife. I mean, she experienced all this too, right? I mean, she lost everything too. She lost 10 children. She was really distraught. And then she looks at Job once he's now physically, he's deformed, basically, and she looks at him, and there's no, believe me, physical attraction there on her part for him now, the way he looks. And he apparently says to her, well, you know, I'm still bless God in the midst of this. And then she probably just ticked her off. Why don't you just curse God and die? You know, don't be such an idiot. Don't be such a fool. Look at you, you know. And then he goes off into the garbage dump. There he is. I mean, you talk about, you know, going from the throne room to the doghouse, to the, you know, the outhouse or whatever. I mean, this guy, you know, had really taken a tremendous fall in life. And yet, what does he do? He remains steadfast to God. And he's in the midst of this garbage dump. And what is he doing? He's scraping his boils. And then three friends come. All right? Now, when we get further on in the book of Job, we will discover that there's a fourth friend. Apparently, he comes later. All right? And he's the youngest of these, of Job's friends. But these friends come, and they look at him. They don't even recognize him. He is so physically deformed. They don't even recognize him. Have you ever seen somebody like that, maybe in the hospital or wasting away with cancer or something, and just a few months before you saw them and now you see them, and it's like you don't hardly recognize them? Well, they look at him and they don't even know what to say to him. They just sat down there to be with him. They couldn't say a thing, all right, because what could they say? To me, that was their greatest wisdom. Sometimes when you see Christians that are suffering and other people that are suffering, I think it's pretty shallow if you go up to them and flip a coin and say, you know what, all things work together for good for those who love the Lord. You know, adios, we'll see you later, flip a coin, walk out or something. I mean, to me, that's very, very shallow. Sometimes your greatest wisdom is just put your arm around a person that's suffering greatly and just comfort them by your just being there, just their presence, just to know that, hey, man, there's somebody who cares for you. And they're not going to be spouting off Scripture because God's thoughts aren't our own thoughts, and there's no way I can explain this to you because I don't understand it myself, but I'm here with you and I'm going to see this through with you because I love you and I care for you. You know, I mean, sometimes that's all you can do. That's our greatest wisdom. Sometimes with people going through very deep trials. Does anybody have anything to add or share to this? Listen, this is chapter 3. They went to chapter 3. It says, afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. May the day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of day terrify it. As for the night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those who curse it curse the day, and those who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Let the stars of the twilight be darkened. Let it wait for the light, but have none. Neither let it see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide the trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, and why the breast that I should suck? For now I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then, I would have been at rest with kings and with counselors of the earth who rebuilt the ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who were filling their houses with silver, or like a miscarriage which is discarded. I would not be as infants that never saw the light. There the wicked cease from raging, and there the weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together, and they do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who suffers, and light to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none, who dig for it more than hidden treasures, who rejoice greatly, they exult when they find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, who and whom God has hedged in? For my groaning comes at the sight of my food, and my cries pour out like water. For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I am not at rest, but a turmoil comes. Now here's the thing. As this unfolds, that now Job, instead of cursing God, what does he do? He cursed his existence. He cursed the day he was born. He curses this. And the way he does it, is, I think it's kind of significant. If you count the number of times, I think it's like 17 different times or so that he's making these different analogies as far as wishing the day that he was born, the very day that he was born, be wiped out of God's calendar altogether. I mean, it'd be completely lost in darkness. I mean, have you ever been in that point in your life where things are just so overwhelming, you just wish you could find some hole, some crack, some crevice in the universe to crawl into and become non-existent? I mean, that's the way he felt. Just like, hey, I wish I never existed. I wish I was never born. And then he goes through this kind of litany as far as, first of all, I wish I was never even conceived. And if I had to be conceived, then I wish I was never fed at my mother's breast, because I wish I was just left to die. Before that, he even said, if I was conceived, I wish I was stillborn. And if I have to be born, I wish my mother would never fed me. I wish I would just died at infancy. Because he's making all these analogies where he's just saying, if I just could have died, and not seen the light of day, or if I had to see the light of day, if I was just died at birth, or if I didn't die at birth, if I had just died as an infant, I wouldn't have seen all this trouble coming. All right? And that's the way he feels. And now he's not cursing God. He's cursing his whole life. He just wished he was never born. I mean, have you ever been there? This poor guy, when I read this, I do, my heart really aches for him. But here's the thing that I think kind of really ticks me off, because if you read this on that verse 25, it says, for what I fear comes upon me, and what I dreaded befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet, for I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. In other words, I've heard people say this, and it really does bug me, but I've heard people say, aha, look what Job said. He said, for what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. In other words, they said, this all came upon Job because he was a negative thinker. You see that verse 25? He said he feared this, he dreaded this, and that's why it happened to him. I remember many years ago going up to a retreat, and there was a guy who was giving a talk, and he's giving a talk about the power of the tongue, and he's saying how you could create things with the tongue, and so on and so forth, and how you could create your circumstances. And I thought, this guy's way off base. And I was just a pretty young Christian. I thought, this guy, this is BS. This is baloney. But there's a lot of people today that are like that. They just feel like, hey, if you've got to be a positive thinker, you've got to be a positive person. You can't ever think negatively, because if you think negatively or if you speak negatively, that's going to happen to you. Have you ever heard that? I mean, I hear it all the time. That's why I wear these shirts that say, don't be happy, worry, or, you know, it's not going to happen. I know people would be on me for that, but I'm telling you, all of Job's troubles did not come upon him because he may have feared this. In other words, the guy, he was offering up sacrifices for his children because he had a fear that maybe inadvertently somebody had offended God. And so it wasn't like he brought this on himself, but that's what they're trying to say. Anyway, long story short, this is how this dialogue begins to unfold here, about he giving one example after example after example after example of wishing that he was never born. All right? Yeah.
I'm kind of confused here, because you're saying he's not, you know, going after God, but if he's wishing he never was born and wishing he never existed, isn't that kind of...
Well, he's not cursing God. He's just cursing his life. He's just, you know, and I think there's a big difference there, all right? I see that you can make a roundabout connection. I could see how you could do that.
I'm thinking God gave us this life, so, I mean, to be grateful for what he gave him instead of...
I know what you're saying, but what you need to do is, best as you can, you need to put yourself in his position. Imagine that this has all happened to you, and yet you still believe firmly in God, and you still believe firmly in God's goodness, and you had no answer as to why God was doing this to you, but you didn't dare curse God, and all you wanted to do was just die. Now, is that cursing God because you want to die? You wish you were never born? See, that's not cursing God, all right? But he's just desperate. He just wants out of the situation. It's just overwhelming to him. I think we could all appreciate that. But, you know, but before I close, look what he says in when he starts cursing the day of his birth, the day that he was born, and wishing he was never born, he makes reference to here. He said that's at verse 8. Well, back up to verse 4. It says, "Behold, let the night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those who curse it, who curse the day, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan." In other words, he wants the people who have no fear of cursing to curse the day of his birth. All right? Because he says here, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Now, here's the interesting thing. Leviathan is a very interesting term. It's very interesting because Job describes the Leviathan, when we get into, I think, the 40th chapter of Job, and it's really a dinosaur that he's describing, you know. But interesting thing is the devil is referred to in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, as a great red dragon, all right? You know what dinosaur means? It means a terrible lizard. And you know what's kind of interesting? Is that reptiles are virtually the only creatures on the face of the earth, along with a few fish, that will continue to grow during their whole lifespan. You look at some of these Komodo dragons that they have in Indonesia. Some of them weigh 2,000 pounds. One-ton lizard. You imagine something like that in your living room? All right? Well, keep something in mind. These things continue to grow, and reptiles will continue to grow all their life. And if you stop and consider for a second that before the Noachian flood, before God destroyed the world with the flood, and before the canopy, you know, caved in, the whole thing, I don't have time to get into that, but man had been living for centuries. And so when God created these reptiles, they continued to grow for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they grew to these enormous sizes that we see as dinosaurs today. You know, only about 10% of the dinosaur fossils that they do find, they do uncover, are these big mammoth dinosaurs. Most of them were no bigger than a dog, all right? Many of the reptiles that we see today. But we do see enough in the reptiles today to know that they will continue to grow. Well, the Leviathan, I don't have time to get into it tonight, but it's described in minute detail in, I think, the 40th chapter of Job, the 41st chapter. He describes a land dinosaur and a marine dinosaur, all right? And we'll get to that when we get further on into the book of Job. But what's interesting is the devil is also referred to as Leviathan. Interesting thing what Isaiah says in Isaiah 26 and 27. He says, in verse 19 of 26 in Isaiah, says, "Your dead will live, and their corpses will rise. You who live in the dust, awake and shout for joy, for your dew is as the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits." In other words, Isaiah is speaking of the day of resurrection, all right? And he says this, "Come, my people, enter into your rooms and close your doors behind you. Hide for a little while until indignation runs its course. For behold, the Lord is about to come out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity, and the earth will reveal her bloodshed and will no longer cover her slain." In other words, Isaiah is predicting a day, all right, when the rapture will take place, when God will take away his people and do what? He will punish the world for its evil. And what will he do? He says here that the earth will reveal her bloodshed. Look at the millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of children that have been murdered in this country alone in the womb. All right? Over about 47 million children. Then multiply that worldwide. Well, all this is going to be revealed on the day of a bloodshed and will no longer cover the slain. In other words, everything will be revealed as far as men's sins are concerned in that day. But then he goes on to say in verse 1 in chapter 7, "In that day the Lord will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, with his fierce and great a mighty sword, even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea." In other words, this is also referred to as the devil. Leviathan is also referred to as the great red dragon. So what I'm saying is here, when Job is mentioning this situation, all right, as far as that verse 8, "Let those who curse it curse the day who are prepared to rouse Leviathan." He's talking about here a dinosaur, all right, that this fierce, mighty creature that no man would dare go near. He says, let a man who has, well, courage or stupidity as to go forth and curse one of these fierce reptiles. Challenge them. Let this man curse that day. All right, here's the thing. If you break this down, you see where Job is coming from. Job is just at his wit's end. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been to the point where you just want to, you know, I mean, I know I've been there at my point where sometimes I feel like the devil's just so pounding on me and so oppressing me at times that I just feel like I just want to take one more step and, like, just step out of my body and let my body just collapse on the floor, and I just keep going, just to get out of here. You know what I'm saying? That type of thing. That's the way Job got. He just got to that point where, rather than cursing God for the things that had happened to him, he was just cursing his life. He just says, what's the point to this? I don't get it, man. And how many of us would have been able to endure what Job did to this point? I mean, he continued to trust God. He continued to believe in God. He continued to refrain from cursing God for all of his misfortune. But he got to the point where he was so miserable in his poor life, he just wanted to die. I mean, I'm telling you, the first time I read this story, I'll be honest with you, I wept for the man. I really did. I just thought, oh, this poor man. I mean, I just can't believe what he went through. But I found a great deal of inspiration through his perseverance through this. Yeah.
I was going to tell you, as you know, I went through a period much like Job. And I'll never forget being with you one time and having deep anguish and stuff. And you telling me the scripture, be still and know that I am God, was one of the scriptures I clung to for a while. It was such a comfort to meditate on that one scripture and remember that day bringing some peace that day, and it does.
Yeah.
To just be still and know that I'm God.
Yeah. Well, in the midst of all our suffering, I think that's what we need to do, because we have to understand Isaiah 55, it says, God's thoughts aren't our thoughts, His ways aren't our ways. His thoughts and His ways are higher than the heavens are high. And we look out there, we can't see the end of the heavens. That's how infinitely beyond our comprehension God's ways are. And look at Job. I mean, when we get to the end of the story here, God never explains to Job, what was going on. Never told Job what was going on.
And he never asked.
Instead, what God does is He fires one question after another, to Job and says, Job, answer these questions. If you can answer these questions, then you're in a position to question me. But God never told him, hey, there's a devil involved here, that this has been a challenge that's been thrown out. Never told him anything. All right? But Job does mention one point in his anguish. He says, oh, I just wish that my words, my feelings, my thoughts were written with an iron stylus or a pen into granite or to rock. And when I read that, I thought, you know what? They are. They are. The guy didn't realize, but his words were, because they have become eternal words. You know what I'm saying? They will never be lost, you see. But the poor guy didn't know what he's going through. But I know Job's in heaven now. And if we were to go up and ask Job, would you be willing to go through it again? I think he would say yes, now that he has the hindsight, because he has seen the tremendous good that has come out of his suffering for the multitudes of people throughout history, you know. And it's like it was a tremendous honor for him to go through that. But look at when he was going through that, he just felt completely overwhelmed with despair. So, again, not to sound shallow, not to sound flippant, but what does the Bible say? All things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to His purpose. So when we are going through deep waters and difficult times, we really have to look at Job. And we have to say, you know what? There's something going on here that I don't see, but I have to trust God. Because that's what Job says. We're further on in our reading. He says, though he slay me, I will trust him. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?
Well, I have a question about what you just said. That verse, all things work together for good for those who love the Lord. You know, because I, as most people who know, have gone through similar Job-type things this past year. Sorry. To the point where I wanted to die. So I could be just not suffering. And it's like that verse, and I've had those kind of questions too, and that verse, it doesn't mean that it's for your good. It's for God's good. So like when all things work together for the good, well, it says for those who love the Lord, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily what you want.
Well, it is for your good, too. Because here, keep something in mind, all right? Just keep this in mind. Look what happened to Job. He was blameless. He was upright, you know, fearing God, turning away from evil. That was God's opinion of him. You think the guy can't get any better, can he? But let me tell you something. Once he went through the fire, he came out seven times better, didn't he? Because he came out a better man he was a great man going in. He came out a better man. You couldn't think he would get any better, but it was his experience when he went through it and he came through it. He actually became a better man. And he could look back over that and he could see how the hand of God had moved in his life in such a way that it made him a deeper person than he already was, a better person than he already was. So it really was, I think, for his good, not just God's, all right? It's for our own good. God is always meeting a deeper need. Remember when the paraplegic, they lowered down Jesus through the roof? He's there. He's paralyzed from the neck down, all right? Not just the waist down, all right? They put him down on a sheet. Jesus said, "Take courage, my son. Your sins are forgiven." And, of course, the Pharisees said, "Well, who's this guy? He can't forgive sins." But Jesus did say, he says, what's easier to say? Take up your pallet and walk, or your sins are forgiven? Well, it's easier to say your sins are forgiven because nobody knows for sure if they were or not, right? All right? But to prove that he had the power to forgive sins, he said, take up your pallet and walk. But here's the thing, all right? Keep this in mind. Everybody could see his need. It was obvious. Heal the poor guy. He can't even move, right? But Jesus saw a deeper need, and he met the deeper need first. He met the spiritual need first. So what you're going through, what other people are going through, sometimes God is meeting a deeper need before he meets the obvious need.